Today's audio cast for Monday, June 18th, 2007 from AvWeb, the world's premier independent aviation news resource, is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. I'm Mike Blakeney reporting. Robert Poole, Director of Transportation Studies at nonprofit think tank Reason Foundation, has long been an advocate of aviation user fees, as well as a supporter of commercializing the U.S. Air Traffic Control Organization. In an interview with AvWeb Editor-in-Chief Chad Troutvetter, Poole explains why he sees user fees and a privatized ATC system as good things for airspace users, despite what aviation alphabet groups have been saying about user fees.
Reason Foundation is a nonprofit think tank based in Los Angeles. Its focus is to try to apply free market principles to public policy questions. I've been researching the problems with air traffic control as provided by the FAA for more than 20 years, and I've come to the conclusion that we really could do a lot better than providing this vital high-tech service with a government agency, a government bureaucracy constrained as it is by the federal budget and civil service rules and so forth. I've seen the examples overseas of basically corporatizing, setting up usually government corporations, occasionally nonprofit corporations that really run as true businesses and respond to the needs of their aviation users, and are self-funding through fees and charges paid by those users. And I think that's really the best model for the United States.
AOP, MBAA say that the models in the other countries don't work and that they suppress GA. What do you say to that?
Well, there's sort of a chicken and egg situation involved there. I mean, Europe has very congested airspace, and they do have high user fees that GA is subjected to, and so you do have a much smaller GA market there, or GA field or industry. Canada, I think, is a better example. Canada has thriving general aviation and does not charge direct fees to Piston GA. They charge an annual membership fee that's based on the weight of the plane, and you know you pay it, and then you have access to you can use towered airports and things like that. And that way you don't get into problems, people having to make a trade-off: should I pay and fly safer, or not pay and maybe fly less safe? Those questions don't arise in Canada. So I think actually the Canadian model is probably the best one for us to look at.
How should user fees be allocated? By aircraft, by passenger, or by capability of aircraft?
The primary unit should be, what does it cost the air traffic system to provide the services to a plane? And so a plane that's flying IFR in altitudes, especially altitudes where there's a lot of traffic, those planes should basically be paying something in the same ballpark of fees. If planes are flying in out-of-the-way space where there's fewer services provided, they would be paying less. I mean, that's a general overall principle, but it should be for the services provided. And it doesn't matter how many passengers are on the plane. You know, that's irrelevant as far as providing ATC services is concerned. It's really how dense the traffic is and how often you have to provide various services. It really does make sense. Once you have a user fee type system, it's quite possible, feasible, and desirable to give discounts for equipage that allows the planes to take advantage of the new services and fit better into the next-gen system. And we already actually see that. The corporatized providers in Canada and the UK give discounts over the North Atlantic for planes that are equipped with controller pilot data link and ADS-B. So there you go, is an example that's already in operation.
Now, what do you think about the Senate bill that's in play right now? It has a $25 user fee for IFR turbine traffic.
It's a first step toward creating a fee that is a reliable revenue stream that's bondable. The intent of that provision is for next-gen modernization, to be able to issue bonds, real revenue bonds like are used for airports and in other forms of transportation, to buy the new equipment and the new facilities that are needed to really implement the next-gen system. With a user fee, as opposed to, taxes have to be appropriated every year by Congress. And there's always squabbles over how big the federal budget deficit is and how much general support there's going to be and how much is going to come in from the tax levels and so forth. It's hard to go to Wall Street and finance, issue bonds based on that kind of an uncertain revenue stream. user fee, once it's authorized, is basically permanent. And when you issue bonds based on it, you make covenants with the bondholders that says, yes, we are going to keep that in place until the bonds are paid off. So it is a good way to provide a dedicated revenue stream for the, and it's estimated it would provide about $5 billion worth of bonds to pay for a lot of the new expenditures.
It's being billed as a reliable revenue stream, but really it fluctuates on traffic just like a fuel tax would.
Well, except though that a tax, you don't get to spend the tax unless and until Congress appropriates it, and the markets have trouble with that. They would much rather have a fee that they would take some degree of risk with how much traffic is there going to be 5 years from now compared to today, and therefore how much how many of those units of $25 would actually get charged. But they can quantify that risk. They find it harder to quantify the risk of knowing what a Congress is going to do 5 years from now if there's major pressure to cut the federal budget, for example. Let me mention another point that's also part of the Senate bill, that the spending decisions on that money that would come from issuing the bonds backed by the user fees would be made by a board that has strong representation from aviation users. Now, I don't think the Senate bill goes far enough in that. It only has, I believe, three user representatives on the board. I would think it should have, eight or nine. But the principle is a very important one, that the users ought to be calling the shots on this and saying, this investment does make sense, this one over here doesn't. It's just nice gimmicks that the FAA engineers would like to have, but doesn't really provide value for the money. That is a crucially important change that is the kind of thing that we see on the actual board of directors of NAV Canada, where airlines and business aviation users have seats on the board and are actually able to say yes or no to annual budgets and capital spending decisions. They decide which programs get implemented and which ones don't.
The GA alphabet groups would say, well, that means the airline's going to control the board. How do you...
Well, that depends on how the board is structured. And the legislation, I believe it only gives two seats, I think, in the Senate version to airlines and one to general aviation. Now, you can quibble with that specific framework. I had actually proposed in some of Reason's writings four airline seats and three GA seats and one airport board seat and several other types of things, one for the employees, mostly the controllers, presumably, because they have an interest in all these things also. I think the important point is to get the principle established, and Congress is going to be the one making the decision about how many seats for how many stakeholders, and I think clearly I don't intend to see this as something that the airlines could dominate, even though I know that's the way it's being portrayed by IOPA and NBAA and so forth.
Can we get to the safety aspect?
Sure.
You had mentioned it in the Canada model that it's a flat fee per year, and you say there's no impact on safety as far as the Canadian model is concerned?
Right. And no one, to my knowledge, is proposing in any of these countries, and certainly no one in this country, in the United States, is proposing to charge GA pilots for filing a flight plan or getting a weather briefing. That really could have safety implications, and nobody wants to see that. We want to do this in a way that that does provide a fair sharing of the costs of maintaining the system that's related to how much people use of the system services, but clearly one that does not force people to make a trade-off between flying safer and paying money. We don't want to do that.
No, it's very easy for people to say that that privatization or corporatization won't always work, and they're going to point to the current situation where Lockheed Martin is having problems with the flight service for the flight service stations. What would you say to that?
Well, what I'd say to that is that that contract is a good example because it's clear that if Lockheed Martin doesn't fix those problems in a reasonable time period, they are at risk of having that contract yanked. And so there actually is accountability there. When the FAA itself, as a government bureaucracy, is providing services and pilots complain, it's pretty hard to get things changed. They are the FAA. They are going to be there regardless. So I think there is a degree of additional accountability brought about by bringing in a contract provider like that, where you can have performance penalties and ultimately the ultimate sanction of yanking the contract and either taking it back in-house or putting it out to bid, hopefully to get a better contractor.
Let's talk about the contract employees themselves, the proposed air traffic controllers under contract, and right now the flight service station guys are, you know, they're working for a contractor. Say that somebody working for a privatized ATC system or for flight service gives incorrect information to a pilot by mistake and it causes an accident. Is that employee personally liable?
Let me clarify something before we go further. I when I say we should corporatize air traffic control, I'm not talking about contracting it out to a private company. I'm talking about a reform in place, which is what they did in Canada. NAV Canada is the same people, the same controllers, the same facilities as was there before. Those people went home one day as Transport Canada employees, came back to work the next day, and they were NAV Canada employees. And they kept their benefits, they kept their retirement programs. But from then on, they were no longer protected by civil service. They were the employees of the new entity that that basically transformed the old organization. So, I mean, there is an option if things really get bad in air traffic control. One other option that Congress could do is to outsource. You could outsource Oceanic air traffic control to one company and outsource Tracons to somebody else. I don't think that's a good solution, and that's not at all what I mean when I say privatization or corporatization. I'm talking about a thoroughgoing reform of the existing air traffic organization, spinning that off from the FAA as a freestanding, self-supporting entity accountable to its aviation customers. You know, the subject of user fees is scary for many people. It's fighting words to a lot of private pilots. But I don't see user fees as an end in themselves. It's a means to the end of financial independence for an air traffic control organization that has worked successfully to bring that about in over 40 countries around the world in the last 20 years. And I think we really can transform the existing air traffic organization into a serious, cost-effective, entrepreneurial company that does what its users want it to do and need it to do, and ends up ultimately costing a lot less than the FAA bureaucracy today.
And do you think it's more efficient from a standpoint of implementing NextGen?
Yes, indeed. I mean, NextGen is a very high-risk enterprise. I mean, this is at least as big a change as the introduction of radar in the 1950s. And it involves a lot more advanced technology in which there definitely is risk. I think transforming the organization before trying to implement NextGen is the best way to reduce the risk of a huge fiasco. You need to have an organization that has the very best talent, engineering management talent recruited from the private sector, and engineering managers responsible for implementation who can be held accountable for delivering results and fired if they can't perform and deliver results. You don't get that within the FAA today. It has a terrible track record, I'm sad to say, of implementing high tech. And when you start moving into the biggest and riskiest high tech project in the entire history of air traffic control in this country, I think we need a different kind of organization make it more likely to succeed.
So that would mean no more presidential appointments of FAA administrators. It would be a
Correct.
More market-based,
Correct.
Like a CEO.
You would still have an FAA with an administrator as the safety regulator that would be at arm's length overseeing the air traffic organization, and just like it's at arm's length overseeing Boeing and airframe engine manufacturers, Pratt & Whitney and GE and so forth. But the ATO itself would be a freestanding, self-supporting corporate entity with a board representing the aviation users.
Would it take a large organization or a fee? What would the cost of collecting this be?
Yeah, the cost of collection would be trivial. I recently was at the FAA and got copies of, you know, they do overflight billing today of planes that traverse U.S. airspace, like going from Canada to Mexico or any other there, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of overflights every month. Almost all airliners, but some of them are business jets, and you basically have information that gets automatically taken right off the flight plan of how many miles they fly and what time they entered airspace, U.S. airspace, what time they left. There's a standard set of rates, and the billing is basically created by software. and it cost them you know, a few cents to do each bill, and they have 2.5 people at FAA in charge of handling all that.
So you're saying there's already a structure in place to...
There's already a structure in place, and it's simply a matter of scaling it up somewhat. Scaling it up a lot, but it's not at all labor-intensive. It's mostly software.
Now, where can people go to read more of the white papers that the Reason Foundation has published?
They're all available on the Reason website, www.reason.org/airtraffic.
Okay.
Robert Poole of the Reason Foundation. Hey, be sure and check out www.fweb.com. Now you can get 24/7 updates and news alerts. Sign up is free. We won't spam you or sell your name. Comments on this audiocast welcome at audionews@avweb.com. This report was brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention. Look for Avweb's next audiocast on Friday, June 22nd, when Avweb's Russ Niles will speak with a Chicago Mooney pilot who used a little electronic wizardry for a happy outcome when his engine ate an exhaust valve at 7,000 feet in IMC. I'm Mike Blakeney for Avweb Audio. Thanks for listening.